For months now, President Trump has been putting the screws on Modi of India, trying to get him to decouple from Russia, trying to put a wedge between Russia and India, especially the oil, to try and harm Russia. That hasn't exactly had an overwhelming success. The United States has a 50% tariff on India, hasn't come off yet. And overnight, President Putin of Russia went to India on a state visit. Let's just say it didn't go as well as President Trump may have wanted. As a matter of fact, there's very, very friendly relations between the two there. You can see some of the scenes of the visit, of the state visit. There was actually some images when Putin got off the plane last night and he was met at the airport by Modi. Huge smiles and faces. A lot of happiness, and I was actually on Indian TV providing some commentary last night on the CNN version of out of India, and they were just beside themselves. I mean, this is a big deal for India, and one of the interesting things I'll just say as an aside before we really even get into what Putin had to say. And by the way, he did have some very important things to say and some stark clarity on exactly how they view things, which is vitally important, by the way, for us to understand how this war can come to an end and what's going to be necessary for it to do so. But one thing is the Indians, many of the guests that were interviewed there, they had an economics guy, they had a retired three-star general, et cetera. And these guys were tired of being forced to make a choice. You see, we don't want to have to choose between anybody. We don't want anybody to compel us to have to submit to their way of thinking of things. And look, India's got a lot of history with being compelled to do things they didn't want to do by great powers, i.e. Britain. You know, in the past, all the imperial stuff that they had in the past that they relieved themselves from. So they're not kindly displayed towards saying, yeah, you're going to force us to do something that's antithetical to our national interest. To get in between you and your challenge at this strategic level between Russia and the United States. So that didn't go over very well, and you could see it really on display here. You've already seen it with Modi in the fact that even though there's been this 50% tariff put on him, it has not resulted in them stopping selling or buying oil from Russia. And that, as of this meeting here last night, they also had a number of economic and strategic agreements that were signed. I think there were 10 of them. And bottom line is they continue to say we got to have good relations. They're both charter members of BRICS, and they're going to continue to go down that path. So if Trump thought that his pressure tactics would put a wedge, he has been mistaken. And that has now been shown very clearly it's not. Now, getting back to Vladimir Putin. Obviously, the purpose of this was to explain to his Indian audience exactly where he is on things. And of course, whereas Trump is trying to put a wedge between India and Russia, Putin is trying to put a wedge between India and the United States. And we'll see in time which of these two had the more success. But given some of Trump's rather erratic behavior, even without this visit, I think it was already moving in the direction of India trying to placate Trump and doing as little as they could while playing for time, because they want to get back to this, their role that they desire, which is to not take anybody's side. They don't want to take China's side. And there was a lot of angst among the Indians with China because they've had a long-term simmering, challenging relationship. These, you know, two nations with over a billion people on each other's borders. And they don't want to take Russia's side overtly, and they don't want to take America's side, and they don't want to antagonize any of them either. They want to continue on doing things that are in their national interest that benefit their country without alienating anybody else, and they don't appreciate being forced into it. But in part of this, there was a long-form interview with Vladimir Putin with several, actually, Indian questioners, interviewers. And he said a number of very, very important things that I hope that President Trump and Steve Witkoff and his negotiating team were paying a lot of attention to, because Putin really laid out some things that is vital, vital for us to understand if we actually want to bring this war to a conclusion besides a Russian military victory. That path is still open, but the window is closing. And I think if we get too much further down, there won't be a point for Russia to continue even talking, and then they'll simply move on the battlefield. Once it gets to a certain point, and especially if the Ukraine military eventually buckles, there won't be any room for negotiations. It'll be too late. let's get to what we're talking about. So the first thing that he was asked is, he was asked, why did they start this, what the Russians call a special military operation, what the Ukrainians call a full military invasion, et cetera. And Putin says, hey, this was not started because we wanted to.
Our special military operation is not the start of a war, but an attempt to end it. To end the war that the West unleashed against us through the hands of Ukrainian nationalists. That is what is really happening. This is the essence of the problems taking place. And we will finish when we decide to.
Now, I, just to be clear here, I'm not taking, I also am not taking anybody's side here. I'm not going to validate anything that that Putin said. I'm not going to say he's right on this or that. I'm going to tell you what he said and what he believes, and then how that translates into actions. And anyone who wants to pay attention to those things can benefit from it, because if you understand someone's motivation and their genuine motivation and where their pressure points are and where their incentive points are, where you can try to move and find common ground, there's information there to be found. And if you want to reject it, if you want to act like, and I could have put it up here, Keir Starmer, Emmanuel Macron, especially Friedrich Merz, Mark Rutte et al., all those, Ursula von der Leyen. They don't want to listen to anything he says. They literally won't give him the time of day. If Putin said, hey, the sun's going to come up in the east tomorrow, they would challenge that just because it came out of his mouth, etc. So you can just take them off the table. They have made themselves non-players in this because they refuse to have any kind of just normal intellectual open-mindedness. They don't actually want to get this over. They only want to find a way to have their way to be manifest on the ground. It's not going to. And unfortunately, they don't have the cognitive ability or the emotional intelligence. I don't even know what the right word is here, but they're unwilling to acknowledge reality. So let's take them off the table here. So really, this, even though this was in India, this is primarily between Trump and Witkoff and his team and Vladimir Putin. I think those were the real audience for this whole thing here. And let's see what we can find here. First of all, Putin said there, listen, this was something that they felt that was forced upon them. They say, this is not something we chose, and we're not fighting this to win a war, he said. We're fighting this to end one. And as he's going to say here in just a second, this war didn't start on February 24, 2022, but it started much earlier than that. That's also important to understand. You don't have to agree with Putin, but you do have to understand where he's coming from and how he views things. Because if you don't know that, then you won't know how to actually find a way to end it. If you're just thinking this all started on February 2022, then you're going to miss the boat here, because you're talking from two separate sheets of music. The second thing is, and this was more illustrative, that it seemed kind of like just a casual statement at the end where he says, and we'll decide when it's over. That's the word of someone who is supremely confident, who has looked at the balance of power between the two sides. And I don't mean Russia and Ukraine. I mean Russia and the West at large. So that's all of these 50 NATO nations that have been helping. It's Ukraine itself. It's their manpower. It's their collective ability at the defense industrial base. It's their collective stockpiles of weapons. It's at the political realm that's going on, in which all these different leaders have to operate, and the problems that they're facing, and the same thing on the Russian side. And of course, Putin is somewhere around 80% approval just on the domestic front. So he already is in a very, very comfortable place, quite in opposition to all those European leaders I just mentioned, all of whom has just hideous approval ratings. I think Trump is at the top of the list at 36. That tells you a lot, because a lot of people in the United States are talking about how weak he is, and yet he's at the top of all these other guys I just mentioned. So they're having a lot of political turmoil at home. There's already been a lot of voting and elections that have not gone the way that these guys want, these collective leaders. That's only going to continue. Putin sees all of that. And of course, most decisively, he sees the military balance between the two, the manpower issue. He recognizes what I've been preaching for the last 4 years almost. It's about men. It's not about money and machines as much. You can have a ton of money and a ton of machines, and it won't make any difference if the manpower pool to use them is insufficient, and if whatever you have is insufficiently trained, and it is on the Ukraine side. So Putin recognizes that, and he's like, okay, this will end when I decide it's going to end. Now, Zelensky makes a lot of cocky statements too, and there's a difference between cocky and confident. Putin is confident. Zelensky is cocky, and cocky in the sense that he can't back it up. He's never been able to back it up. All these claims he's been making, really, you can go all the way back to late 2022 when they had their signature successes in the Kherson and the Kharkiv regions. That was going to be it for the war. And he's still living in those days. Just like oftentimes I mentioned, the United States still thinks it's 1991 and we can just kind of rule the world and tell everybody what they're going to do. And they'll just have to grit their teeth and grin it. It ain't 1991 anymore. Well, for Zelensky, it ain't 2022 anymore. That day is you had your one moment in the sun and it's gone. You had a chance to leverage that into something positive. You chose not to do it. You chose to ignore the balance of power and the latent power and possibility and the potential that was on the Russian side. It was always there, even during these times in 2022. It never went away. It just meant that it was going to take time to get a ginned up. Well, we have that moment. Now we're there, and Putin sees that there is literally nothing that the West can do collectively to turn this around. So he can confidently say, we'll decide when this is over. And as he said just barely 2 weeks ago in uniform, we will either accomplish this diplomatically or we will take it militarily. As categorical, as unambiguous as you can get. And as I keep showing you on the front lines, he's making good on that promise. So that's where the war is going to go into. And that's how he's telling me it began. Well, he went into some more detail on that to say exactly why he claims Russia didn't actually start this war.
We did not start this war. The West condoned, facilitated, and organized the coup d'etat in Ukraine. After that, events began in Crimea, and then events started in the southeast of what was then Ukraine, in Donbas. You know, no one talks about this. For 8 years, we tried to resolve these issues peacefully. We signed peace agreements in Minsk, hoping that to resolve this problem by peaceful means. Then it turned out that Western leaders, they said this publicly, never intended to fulfill the Minsk agreements and only signed them to give Ukraine time to arm itself and continue the armed struggle. After 8 years of people being killed in Donbas, we were forced to act. For some reason, no one in the West, no one talked about this. Not a word is mentioned about it. We were forced first to recognize these republics and second to begin supporting them.
Okay. This is really important. I think more important than recognized. Vladimir Putin says he claims they spent 8 years trying to do negotiations. Now, maybe if you can boil it down to a single big problem that we have, if you could only pick one, I might be willing to say that our biggest problem in the West is our unwillingness to acknowledge that the Russians have a point of view. We don't. We just basically say they exist only as a caricature, a new Hitler. That's about it. And the embodiment of evil. So once you say they're in the embodiment of evil, once you say that he's the modern day Hitler, then there's no more talking to him. You can't possibly say, and anybody who ever to this day ever says that even before the start of World War II, that there was anything positive about Hitler, they get roundly condemned. Like, how dare you? You can't say that there's any positive qualities to them even before. It doesn't make any difference. He's Hitler. He's evil. Ergo, everything about the Nazi regime can only be condemned. That's in history. Now then we have that same attitude applied to the Russian side. So we say they don't have a position. They don't have a valid point of view. Nothing they say is accurate. And of course, we claim nothing they say is true. But that's not the case. That's not reality. That's a characterization that we like to put it on there. And to be clear, no, there's no good guys here. Let me make sure everybody is aware of this. Even if you're a pro on the Russian side, there's not really any good guys here. There's just guys. There's guys on the right. There's guys on the left. There's this batch and there's that batch. And each side is working hard to do the best it can using manipulative tools, using deception, using the truth when that works, military means, diplomatic means, economic means, et cetera. Everybody's doing whatever they can to accomplish their objectives and especially in a conflict to do what they can to succeed at the expense of the other side. That's how war works. That's how conflicts work. That's how economic competition works. That's how all of this stuff is. Now, if you want to have the best chance for your side to succeed, what you have to do is take off your angry eyes and start looking through reality, because you have to recognize, all right, this side has, everybody's got a valid position on its own national security and how it views. Everybody has the right, according to the UN and even common sense, everybody has the right to have a safe country. Now, we can dispute over whether they're doing things that are valid or not, or if they do things that impugn on the security of someone else. It's a valid concept and something that can be examined. But what you can't say, you can't start that they don't have a valid security interest. They do. The Russians do have it. I don't care how much you hate Putin. They have it. and their people desire it and demand it of their leaders, like the people of every single country on earth. So if you're looking at Russia and you say, all right, well, what are their positions? What are their valid security interests? And is there anything that we can do? Is there any common ground that exists between the two? If you take off the lens that 100% is evil, then you can see, all right, well, we kind of agree on this and we kind of agree on that. Let's start from those places here and see if we can get into some areas to find out where there can be common ground to where we can end the conflict in such a way that would be beneficial to both sides, and that we can live with this and that we can go forward. Had we done that from 2014 up to 2022, this war would never have started. I'll just say that categorically. Trump always claims that he could have started this way. He had been in office in 2020. If he had won the 2020 election, then there wouldn't have been a war. He may be right. There's a reason to suggest that that's possible. But I'll tell you, it didn't matter who was in office. This war could definitely have been avoided if the entire West, and certainly that includes the Biden administration and all of these European leaders who were in office at that time, there was a deal on the table. Now, of course, it bears claim stating out loud that if the events of 2014 itself had not happened, then there also almost certainly would not have been a war. To be clear, if we're going to be honest, from 1991, when the Soviet Union disbanded and Ukraine became a sovereign country, from that time, and this includes with the Budapest Memorandum when they got rid of their nuclear weapons, from that time until February 21st, 2014, until February 21st, 2014, there was no question about any kind of military action from Russia against Ukraine at all. No question about it. No mobilization of troops, no massing on the border, no talk about we're going to invade you, etc. I think the most that may have happened at any one time was some issue with gas and some policies that Russia was trying to use its gas that may have occurred later too. I can't remember the timing on that. But in terms of any kind of military, there was nothing. Nothing happened in between those times that would have threatened military action on the Ukraine side until February 22nd of 2014, when at the results of the Maidan and all of these protests that happened, et cetera. And then there was a plan in place that was agreed to by Europeans, the Russians, and the Ukrainians, that there would be early elections, that they would resolve these things diplomatically, democratically, through the power of the people making elections. And then and just a few months hence, in May of that year, they would have been new elections, which for sure the West would have won legally and ethically and morally. And then things would have continued on. There was no reason for it to have gotten any more violent than had already happened up to that point. But as we all now know, you had the U.S. ambassador. You had, of course, you know, the ever famous woman in the United States from the State Department that took action on that. And it was recorded on the phone and, you know, how we're working with who's going to be in charge, et cetera. And then we helped along with Europe to overturn that deal on the 21st of February. And then on the 22nd, Yanukovych had to flee and everything went downhill from then. That led to Russia then out of how they perceive self-defense to annexing Crimea. And then the Ukraine military, this is also important for the Western audience to understand and accept. It's a fact. It's not an opinion. It's not a claim. It's simply a recitation of what physically happened on the ground. The Ukraine military then started turning its guns on its own people. And they did not like anybody in from the Russian, ethnic Russian background in their country. In their country. We love to talk about little green men coming in from Russia. We don't ever talk about on our side about what the Ukraine military itself that we helped support did in killing its own people. And there was what turned into be an outright civil war between the two, which then turned into that line of contact that was relatively frozen for the most of the 8 years. And that's why Putin was mentioning that's where the Minsk agreements came into a place. So when Putin says in that previous soundbite, I worked for 8 years to try and bring this to a diplomatic end, there is some justification to what he was saying. They actually had a ceasefire that starts. I think the Battle of Debaltseve, that was kind of the key point there, that the Ukraine military had lost at the hands of the rebels, the so-called rebels in the eastern part. and they were losing that. So then that's what led them to agree to a ceasefire, and that led to Minsk. And then, as Putin is, I think, going to talk about here in another soundbite here, the West used that as a opportunity to buy time to build up the military, and we know what happened with that. So Putin's claim there is that they tried for 8 years to do diplomacy. They did have something close to an unconditional ceasefire. There were a few conditions, but primarily it was a ceasefire that bought time and didn't require anything of the parties other than to basically stop fighting while they tried negotiations. And then he says that was a complete failure, so we're not going to do that again. That's important. That's part of the mentality that goes into Putin right now, his unwillingness to do a ceasefire in the near term, which Trump has been trying to get him to do, an unconditional ceasefire. See, we only think of what happened yesterday. No one thinks about what happened, you know, from 2014 forward, especially during the after the Battle of Debaltseve and then the Minsk Accords themselves. But it's painfully obvious for the Russian side. So when they say no to that, that's part of the reason why. That's important. Let's move on to the next one. Then Putin details a little bit more on why he recognized the Donbas.
We did not recognize the self-proclaimed republics. For 8 years, they declared independence, and we tried to establish relations between the rest of Ukraine and these republics. Then, when we realized that it was impossible, that they were simply being destroyed, we were forced to recognize them, and not just recognize them, but in part of the territory. And within the administrative borders, as they existed back in Soviet times, and later during the period of independent Ukraine, after it gained independence within those administrative borders. And we immediately told Ukraine and the Ukrainian military, people do not want to live with you. They held a referendum and voted for independence. Withdraw your troops from there, and there will be no military action at all. But no, they preferred to fight. Well, now they fought to this point. Basically, that's what it all comes down to.
Now, from the Russian perspective, he said we were forced to recognize the Donbas area, the Luhansk and Donetsk. You can argue whether he was forced. He definitely chose to. And their calculation, based on Russian national interest and the continued escalation and advancement and evolution of the Ukrainian armed forces. Another thing, this was confirmed by the Office of Security and Cooperation in Europe, OSCE. Prior to the 24th of February, 2022, there was a significant uptick in artillery attacks from the Ukraine side against the Ukrainians in the eastern part of the country, the rebels, the so-called rebels. So it's not an empty claim that the Russians say that the Ukraine military escalated the attacks on here. Now, you can claim, you can decide, you know, why did they start doing that? Because there was a lot of Russians built up there at the time. So it's, you know, he said, she said situation that can be decided later on or discovered by historians. There's different viewpoints on that. And there's a lot of mixed issues. And I don't think any side has hands completely clean on that either. But nevertheless, the fact is there was attacks by the Ukrainian side, an increased significant number of artillery attacks along the line of contact by the Ukraine armed forces into the civilian population on the other side that was killing lots and lots of people. And that was the final straw that said that Russia said, all right, now then we're going to recognize their independence. And that happened on the 21st of February, 2022. And of course, then that led to Russia then joining the military force against it because the, you know, the presidents of those two, you know, nascent republic said, oh, we need the Russian military. I think that was all just a bunch of theater at that time, that point, to give the rational and the logic and the justification for Russia to move in there. You can argue about those points if you want. That is what happened. So Russia came in and they started moving. Now, this is one of the first instances where it's time to bring back up this idea that actions have consequences. Now, we can go back to what happened in the Maidan issue. We can go back to what happened with the February 21st, 2022 negotiations and how we sabotaged that. We wanted to do all these things and we wanted it to be bad for Russia. And in a sense, we got what we wanted at that time. We did get rid of the Yanukovych government. We did get rid of the move that they were about to do for the country economically to Russia. We got rid of that. So we got what we wanted here. But this is one of the things I talk about a lot. There were desperate seeds of bitterness that were planted at that time. and then they were watered. So initially, you look like you succeeded, but what you didn't understand was that there are consequences to actions. And some consequences don't happen right away. Sometimes they build up, and they have to be watered and cultivated and cared for. And if not handled properly, they can then emerge with bitter fruit. And that's what we have here. Because of our near-term focus on getting what we wanted today, instead of just doing it the diplomatic and the democratic way, which we claim to champion, and just letting the elections go forward and letting the people make the decision and then benefiting off how that would have worked out, because that could have forestalled all of this that happened, to include, don't miss this, man. If you don't get anything else out of this, understand this. Had those elections gone through, had we allowed democracy as we defend to actually have its way, and we would have gotten the election towards a westward-leaning leader, as almost certainly would have happened, Crimea to this day would still be in Russian hands, almost certainly. Because the Russians didn't have any reason to, because they had already lived under the control of Kiev over the whole territory up until that point, from 1991 up until that moment in 2022. There was no reason to think anything would be different just because of a different election. There had been several elections back and forth. But because we did not let democracy have its way, we decided to impose it. Then Russia felt compelled. You can argue about whether they were forced or not, but that is what they chose, and that was a reaction to what we had. So that was the first negative consequence to our action. The other ones were buried a lot deeper, and so it seemed like we kind of succeeded for the most part. And in fact, a lot of people in the West were thrilled that Russia annexed Crimea, because that gave them a fresh reason to hate Russia and to point to them as being the evil empire and all this kind of stuff. So kind of they were okay with that in the West, because that almost like gave this perpetual reason to hate Russia and to keep them as the enemy and to say that they're just the next Hitler in waiting. The other problem, though, the other things that were so deeper seasoned there had to do with the Donbass. And all of this was this division, this 8-year civil war that was going on, just continued to fester, and the more and more blood gets soaked into these seeds that have been planted. And then finally, everybody had enough. The Donbass republics had enough. The people that lived there, the so-called rebels or the patriots, depending on which side of the line you want to define them from. And then the Russians said, our national interest is no longer, that's it. We're not going to stop any further, because concurrent with every bit of this, you also had at the strategic level, you had Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General for NATO. You had Joe Biden, who you had all these host of leaders in Europe that continued, said NATO will come in to Ukraine. The very thing that kind of started all this friction in the first place back in 2008 at the Bucharest Memorandum, where we said, declared as a NATO alliance, that Ukraine and Georgia would come into the NATO alliance, et cetera. That's what started the fuse. That's kind of what lit the fuse here. And so that kind of came to a head that we were still talking. There had already been, as Larry Johnson has mentioned, there were some, a lot of NATO actions inside of Ukraine at the time. But Stoltenberg just emphatically in your face said, we are still coming in. Nobody has a veto over us. Nobody tells us who comes into our alliance. We decide on our own. And that's when Putin, famous, and I don't think he mentions it here, but in December of 2021, when he gave that last opportunity for a negotiated settlement, where he told Stoltenberg and he told Biden, I'm told by a diplomat that's friendly to the United States, in June of that year, if you go forward with this, there will be war. If you just take NATO off the table publicly and say, well, that's not something we're going to happen, it's going to be neutrality, there won't be a war. So he tried everything in the world diplomatic. So whether you hate Putin or not, what he said there is accurate. They did not have, that he did try diplomacy for 8 years before they took this action here. Now then we are who we are. Now, one of the other things he said in this that's also very illuminating is that he talked about what victory looks like.
It's not about victory, as you so eloquently said. It's profoundly about the undeniable fact that Russia genuinely seeks to steadfastly defend, and will most certainly and resolutely do so, its vital interests, its cherished people who live there, our deeply held values, our time-honored traditions, the beautiful Russian language, and so on, with unwavering determination.
Now, this is important to understand, too. This is something that I think we just dismiss out of hand, and we shouldn't. Because this is part of what Russia considers the heart and soul and core of its reputation, of its character, of its culture. And that's what they feel is at stake here. They feel that part of the problem that started this whole thing was when the Ukrainian government and the aftermath of the 2014 said this whole slew of laws that made it illegal to talk about, use the Russian language, that they suppressed the religious components. Then they ended up closing it outright once the conflict started, et cetera. And that they had been imposing all these draconian things on the ethnic Russians inside of Ukraine. And this, especially this issue with the Russian Orthodox Church, that is a huge, huge issue. The Eastern Orthodox, et cetera. That's a big part of who they are in their culture. And it's not just a throwaway line. That's actually something that they really value very highly. Ever since the Soviet Union, which was atheistic, got rid of all that stuff, they immediately brought it back up. And now it's a central part, even for Putin himself, to at least he claims that. And certainly for many of the Russians, it is an integral part of who they are and their personality. And when he says we want to protect all that stuff, he means it. What I'm telling you is that this is not just about territory for the Russians. This is also about their culture and their heritage. And they feel it is under assault from the West. And there is no possibility in my mind, no chance that Russia is going to go, okay, all right, well, you know what? Witkoff, you got a pretty good point here. You put some pros and cons on the table, and you know, some of these other guys from Europe, they've also put some pros and cons. And I tell you what, we're going to go ahead and just, we'll take that deal on the table that says you get out of Donbass area, Luhansk and Donetsk, and then we'll just let the current line of contact in Kherson and Zaporizhia be the line. That'll be where we end it. And then we'll have whatever kind of other agreements we want. Russia won't agree to that because it is the people in Kherson and Zaporizhia that are integral to the Russians consider them as the same as the citizens that are anywhere else in the hinterland of Russia. They consider them all Russians. And to agree for Putin to agree to, we're going to have this line that divides them and leaves half of them or some percentage of them under the rule of Kiev and just under the hope that they do what they want. I mean, you're going to get right back to where they were during that 8 years and the way that they were compelled and abused from the Russian perspective. The ethnic Russians inside of Ukraine were, you know, as the subject of this 8-year civil war. Russia won't agree to that. There's no chance that they're agreed to that. There's no compelling ability. You cannot coerce the Russians to agree to that. And they're not going to. I mean, the people in Russia would never allow it. The military itself would not allow him to do that, even if he wanted to. And I don't see any evidence that he would even contemplate that. That's like the minimum. And that's why they keep repeating. They go back to that June 14, 2024 lines that Putin said. We've shown it to you many times, where they list all the things: territorial acquisitions, the administrative borders of the four territories, denazification, demilitarization, no NATO status of no militaries at all inside there, and a limitation. So those have not changed. And there's no set of pros and cons and perks and sticks and carrots, that kind of thing. There's nothing that we have collectively on our entire side that would force Russia to give in on any of those things. And so that's one he said at the beginning of this, we'll decide when this is going to be over. Because if they don't get the deal that they want, which is the June 2024 terms, there's no reason for them to stop, and you can't stop them. They will simply keep going on, whatever the cost. And we love to say how much this is costing Russia, and you know that we reiterate that all the time, as though that you know Putin's sitting there thinking, man, if it costs a little bit more, we're going to be in trouble. We're going to be, you know, like this is the U.S. during Vietnam, and if the casualties get to a certain extent, the domestic pressure will be on him to get rid of it. No, the domestic pressure on Putin is him to go farther and harder. You need to understand that. That's where the pressure on Putin is, not the other direction. So these alleged casualties, and I think they're grossly exaggerated in the West for our purposes, but there are casualties. So that, you know, and they're not minor either. They're not minimal. They do have an impact. But to Russia, they're like what we have paid for. It would be a spit in the face of all the casualties that have happened, the people who have sacrificed their lives already, if they then just stopped where they are. And so they're not going to do that. Now, you can argue that the Ukraine side has also had this sunk cost and that they also don't want to spit in the face of their people that have died. Fair enough, as far as it goes, the desire. But that's why it always gets away. You can eventually strip off all of the accolades. You can strip off the patriotic statements and all that kind of stuff. Get down to the core. What can you do? and what can't you do? And right now, the Russians can compel compliance on all of their June 2024 lines. We can't. We cannot compel them to do anything that we don't want or that they don't want. And that's the core issue here. That's the reason for the confidence of the Russian president. That's the reason why he has no problem sitting there and telling him all the things according to his view that he sees, because he knows that somebody who's not emotionally involved will listen to what he says and kind of put it in the balance and look at what has happened, look at the pieces on the ground and go, hard to argue with some of that. And I think that's probably what's happening in India today and in other parts of the world that are not tied in with the West. Unfortunately, however, I do have to end on this one point here. The West, on the other hand, has not changed at all. These things, of course, don't even occur to the West, and we have resolutely refused to recognize that there are consequences to actions. We've seen all these things that have grown up and these negative consequences that happened right away. Now then, all these other consequences that have happened in between the last 4 years, where there is now hundreds of thousands, if not over a million Ukraine people who are dead today. Certainly, you know, whole swaths of the country are gone, never to come back. Even if you got this line of contact, it's still a tremendous loss to the Russian side that's never coming back. That's what's happened so far. But now then, here in the West, and I go to him a lot just because he's kind of representative of what this class of so-called elite in the West think, and that's General Jack Keane. Now, he is here going to be talking about, in light of everything that I've said, in light of all these meetings that happened between Witkoff and Putin and all the things that have happened since, and the meeting with Macron and Zelensky and all these other kind of meetings, in light of all of that, after all those things, this is just yesterday, he wants to say, here's what I think we should definitely do for the United States. And it's going to include, and I'm not making this up, jets in the air and boots on the ground.
Let's just assume that the Ukrainians are willing to make some concessions, and concessions over territory, for example. That means they're going to need some kind of security guarantees going forward. And so do your people understand that what we're trying to say is the Ukrainians, if they're going to make a deal with the Russians, because the Russians have always said, and believe me, I don't think for a minute, regardless of what deal the Russians make, they change this. Their intent is to take Ukraine and topple it. Maybe not in the near term if they make a deal, but eventually they will do that, likely post-Trump administration. So if that's the case, and everybody believes that, and I believe it, I think the Ukrainians believe it, I think the United States believes it, then you have to put something in place to prevent that from happening, and it has to be enduring over time. And what are we talking about? We're talking about U.S. and European air power. If there's a violation, they would strike. We're talking about forces on the ground on the Ukrainian side of the line to make certain if there's any penetration there, those forces are there, one, to deter it, but two, to stop it.
So he is advocating, and you know that behind the scenes he is advocating into the White House, that the United States have some kind of deal that has American jets patrolling the skies and boots on the ground inside of Ukraine, so that if there's any future conflict, we start to fight to stop any kind of future conflict. He is literally hard to believe. Just don't let this pass you by unnoticed. He is literally saying, let's put American military on the ground in Ukraine, which we now know is this horrifically corrupt entity that makes these terrible decisions, that has been siphoning off hundreds of millions of dollars and likely in the billions away for their own purposes and their own uses. This is the people that we have been supporting, and you want to put American boots on the ground so that American service members will die if it stays conventional for that Ukraine regime, whatever may come on the other side of it. That is insane. And yet that's what he's asking. Backing up a little bit before that. Remember, I told you at the outset of this, part of the problem is that we don't listen to the Russian side. We only look through our lens of it's he's evil, therefore don't listen to anything. You saw Jack Keane say in the middle of that, he gave the wrong estimate for why Russia did. I just showed you all these things where Putin says, here's my motivation. Here's why I've been acting all the way through here. And you can see it pretty close to lines up with what actually happened. It's plausible based on what he said and what has physically happened. But what you can't make a correlation between words and actions is what Keane just said here. Oh, yeah. Russia just wants to conquer Ukraine. All of it. They want to take Kiev. Look, if that was their objective here, they wouldn't have sent in somewhere around 100,000 troops total into this country of, I think it was like 30-something million at the top. You would not have done that. That was obviously not their objective, because you can't conquer. You can't even conquer one city of Kiev, which is somewhere around 2 million, I believe, with somewhere around 50,000 troops that came into that area. It was clearly to demonstrate, to make a point, come to a negotiated settlement. That's what Russia, that was their plan A, and it nearly worked. And of course, as I've said many times, they were not resourced for plan B. So they literally rolled the dice on hoping A would work. And that was a foolish decision on the Russian part, and they paid dearly for it. But they've recovered from that bad decision. And now they're in the point to where we can do nothing about it. But you see that Keane is trying to tell everybody, everybody believes this. He said, I believe it. Everybody believes it. No, everybody doesn't believe it. And those that do are fooled because of men like you. Because of actions where all the Western media, and certainly the UK and the US, are nearly equally guilty on this. Almost all they ever say, print and TV media alike, is that, you know, the whole Putin narrative. Putin is Hitler narrative. That's not what Putin's doing. And he never stops telling people what he plans to do, what he wants to do. And he even said it again just the other day. He literally laughed in front of the cameras. And see, I keep hearing people talk about how we want to go and conquer Europe. Why would I even want to? That's not our objective. Our objective is to keep our country safe, our Western flank safe, and the people inside of you, the ethnic Russians inside of Ukraine, safe. And he said, we'll accomplish it one way or the other. So he goes back to that. So what he says and what his force structure is doing are both true. However, with that said, Putin also said just a couple of days ago, but if you force war on us, we'll give it to you today, he said. And remember that what I just said there about this really high price that Russians paid because they weren't resourced for plan B. And it was a severe cost to their country, personnel and otherwise, economy and everything else, for about a year and a half. 2 years is just the cost to them. But now that, because they paid that price then, now that they have those resources now, they have a defense industrial base right now that can go up to war against NATO should NATO start a war with them. We don't. We don't have the personnel. We're not trained. We're not equipped for modern war. We're still equipped for Operation Iraqi Freedom in 2003. With a couple of minor changes around the edges. We don't have a clue about what modern warfare is like. Ask the Ukrainians. They'll explain that to you in no short order. Forget, don't ask the Russians. Ask the Ukrainians. They have mocked our changes. Okay? We don't even have that many here. Germany's now trying to get conscription. They're trying to start that process. And their defense industrial base is incrementally higher. And this is across the NATO alliance. It's incrementally higher. Russia is still expanding. So they actually have now significant stockpiles of all the key weapon systems and ammunition, especially missiles and rockets and artillery and drones. They have all of these now stockpiling in large numbers, folks. We don't. In fact, ours continue to dwindle because we send what little we have into Ukraine to slow down the loss on the Ukrainian side. So Russia is saying that we will fight and we will win a war if you start one. And they have the capacity to do it. And what Jack Keane's talking about is theoretical in concept, but not even related to real world on the ground. I mean, you can go into to the stockpiles and you can look if you have access to the classified stuff. You can go to the factories and you can look and you can see where they are. You can see how many there are. You can see what their capacity is. You can see what the manpower pool of workers that we even have to pull from to see what you would have to change significantly to actually ramp it up to a wartime level. Those are all aspirational desires, not matched by realities on the ground. So you keep talking about stuff here that you don't have the ability to back up here. And so if it comes to a clash, you are signing our death warrant. We are going to lose. We have lost the war in Ukraine. That's past tense. The only thing that's still outstanding is how bad the final loss will be. But that's a sure. That's a certainty. What still is an open question is, are we going to be so foolish to listen to the likes of Jack Keane and all these others in Europe that are singing the same tune here that could get us drawn into a conflict with Russia that we would also lose, almost certainly would lose? I can't even imagine militarily taking the emotion out of it, just looking at the balance of power and the strength of will on either of the side and the preparation of the manpower and the troops and the defense industrial base. There's no prospect that we would win that war. And in any case, the cost would be catastrophic. The likelihood of it going nuclear is just through the roof. It seems unlikely to me that it would stay conventional. If we got into a war with Russia and they started winning conventionally, there would be too many weak and terrified leaders on the West, and somebody would buckle. Somebody's going to use a nuclear weapon somewhere, and then all bets are off, and everyone's going to lose. Russia's going to lose. We're going to lose. Ukraine won't even. It'll be a smoldering wreck because that'll probably be the initial conflict zone. And if people like Keane, in his own words, right there. He actually wants to put our troops on the line so that we would get sucked into a war that we have no business fighting, no interest to fight, and no need to fight. Zero. Zero need. We have our nuclear weapons as a strategic deterrent. Russia will never, I will just categorically say, they will never attack a Pearl Harbor stop tile attack against the United States because they know that it would be suicide to do so. So therefore, they won't. That's why if we just listen to what the Russian side says and look at the ground and see what they're doing and see what has happened, we realize the best thing for us to do is to just bring this war to a conclusion as rapidly as possible on the best terms available, as ugly as they would be, and live to fight another day and live to not fight another day. I would be beneficial and preferable. That's what stands before us, folks, right now. That's where we are in this. And one of the reasons why I just say it is time for us to take cognitive, cogent, logical, unemotional action and bring this war to an end in a way that will benefit our side. Russia's been looking at it from their national interest from the beginning. It's time for us to do the same thing. Thank you very much, folks. We really appreciate it. And we'll talk to you next time on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.